She is a long-term researcher here at Computer Institute. She's one of the founding researchers here. She's also a adjunct professor of physics at the University of Waterloo. So these main research areas are, or the main research area is quantum gravity. But he also has a variety of other areas that he's interested in and works on, which is foundations of quantum theory, cosmology, theoretical elementary particle physics, and astrophysics, and theoretical biology. So originally from New York City, Lee graduated from Hampshire College and Harvard University, and taught at Yale, Syracuse, Penn State, and Imperial College before coming to Perimeter in 2001. Lee is author of two books on philosophical and open problems in theoretical physics and cosmology, Life of the Cosmos, and Three Ropes of Quantum Gravity. How many of you have read any of those books? See those books. Great books.
It's great to be here and do this, I talk to the young people who are young scientists, pretty veteran scientists. What I thought I would do, I'm the kind of speaker for whom some people are not like it, but for me, at any rate, I have the most fun when I do talks like this, if I decide what I'm going to talk about 10 minutes before the talk. Okay. So I had planned to tell you about quantum gravity and the whole deal, but I decided that what I would do walking in here, I decided that what I would do is tell you what I'm really worried about, what I'm really thinking about. And so I thought we would just start with gravity. Go back. Because what I'm worried about these days, and I should say, being a researcher is a lot about worrying. Because if you're happy with humanity's understanding of some subject, there's nothing to do. Right? If we understand something, like we understand, I don't know, clocks works or refrigerator works or radios work. I don't understand how radios work, but I trust that somebody understands how radios work. Okay? So if you believe that we understand something, there's no reason to do science. Science is over. So where science is interesting is where we don't know stuff. And if you want to be a scientist, what you got to do is find out what you're worried about and focus on that. There's no sense to me, if it doesn't keep you up at night, then you can do something else for a living. And if there's not something that will keep you up at night, the understanding of which is important enough to you that it's going to really interfere with your life, if you don't understand it better, then there's a lot of good stuff to do in the world. So science is about learning. Science is also about simultaneously being rebellious and respectful. And I'm just going to say this, and then we're going to get to what I'm worried about. Okay. You've got to be respectful of the fact that a whole bunch of people going back thousands of years through all sorts of different traditions have worried about this stuff before. And they weren't dumb. So you've got to be concerned to know what knowledge is passed on to you. You can't just come in from left field and say, I got a whole new way of doing it. I don't care what people thought about before. You gotta care, because a lot of intense, smart, concerned people have thought about this stuff. On the other hand, if there's something to worry about, they blew it, they failed. So you also got to be rebellious. You got to be prepared to say, even if somebody is a professor at the greatest university, even if their name is up there in lights like Einstein and even Galileo or whatever, okay, you got to take the attitude that they blew it and do better than them. Because it can't do better than them. They already did it, so there's no reason for you to do it. Okay? So that's, and I can say more about that if you want me to. By the way, I'm happy, having said that, I assume that you're going to take those attitudes towards me. So I don't mind being interrupted, I can stand up for myself, okay? You can throw anything at me if you want to. Now I'm going to tell you what I'm worried about. I'm working at the start of the breath. So this is what keeps me up at night. Now, what do we know about gravity? Anybody? Yes? Please?
Acceleration.
Okay, tell me about acceleration. Gravity is due to acceleration. Gravity is the cause of acceleration. Okay? Good. Tell me more.
It's the force between Earth and the Earth, the object on Earth.
Okay, so it's, first of all, it's the force between the Earth and objects on the Earth. I drop something, it falls. There's a constant acceleration. Which I don't remember what it is, because since I work on fundamental physics, I use different units. I don't remember. There's some acceleration, 9.8 meters per second squared. Okay. Is that, and it's universal, applies to everything. Okay. Can everybody see if I write here?
Yes.
Okay. Is that all gravity is?
The warping of space-time.
We'll get there.
Yep.
I'm going to put that on the side. Because as you see, I'm worried about stuff which is much prior to that stuff. Okay. Something else? Yeah?
The attraction between two masses.
Okay, there's an attraction between two masses. Don't forget.
Well, any masses in the universe seem to be attracted to each other.
Okay.
Force.
Okay, so between any two bodies in the universe, body one, I don't know why we call them bodies, but there's a lot of stuff in there that's relevant that you would never elsewhere as called bodies. They're like pieces of chalk and pieces of dust and stars and planets, but for some reason, going back to the 17th century, when we're talking about gravity, it's gravity only. Anything gets to be a body. You figure it out, okay? Okay? But there's a force between two bodies. Any two bodies? Can you tell us something about that force?
They both feel some force, but the smaller body reacts more.
Sure. Tell me more about the force.
The force of the edge on our atmosphere.
Okay, so the gravitational force goes by 1 over the distance squared, if that's the distance, okay? And it's proportional to the masses, m, mass of 1, the big 1, let's call them big 1, okay? And there's a constant here called the Lindt constant, right? So this is, and this was due to Newton, this is the force of gravity. Proposed by Isaac Newton in 1687 in his book, The Principia Mathematica. And we can later on talk about what a weird person Isaac Newton was, but. Now just to tie that up with something that I think that somebody else said, you have this other law that force is mass times acceleration, right? And so if I consider thing one and thing two, and so if this is the force on thing one, and it's then the mass of thing one times its acceleration, notice, look at the whole formula. And notice that the mass of the thing, or the body, is the one likes to talk about. And think about what a weird guy he was that everything is a body. Okay? The mass is here and the mass is here, so they cancel. So the acceleration has nothing to do with the mass. I deduce from that the acceleration is just the mass of the other thing times g over r squared. Did everybody see that? And I'm going to use that. So I'm going to put that up here. The acceleration is gravity on something, the Newton's constant times the mass of the other stuff over the distance squared to the other stuff. Okay. That's what we said. Okay. Now, the stuff over here about warping of space-time is 20th century stuff. That's from Einstein, and that's relevant. There's a lot of that's relevant when the speeds are really close to the speeds of light, the masses are really big, stuff like that, I think. And for the moment, I want to stay away from that. Okay. Now, why do we believe this? Why is this stuff in your textbooks? Confirmed by observation, okay? Anybody else? From here to here to here was logic. Okay, I agree with you. Okay. But once it's up there, do we know by logic it's true? Okay. So we need observation. Okay. Does everybody agree with that?
Yeah.
Okay. Here's a proposal from Newton. Newton was a smart guy, but this was hundreds of years ago. So we're gonna be rebellious. We're gonna ask why should we believe that? Okay. And the answer is observation. Okay, and now tell me what observations cause us to believe that these days. Please? I'm gonna make a list of some observations. Okay. Double stars. Tell me about double stars. Get the center?
Yeah. Okay.
What about double stars? They rotate around the center of mass, okay? Okay, so let me ask you a question. If I'm going to check this formula for two stars, I've got to know the distance between them, and I've got to know their masses. Okay? How do I measure those things? You got a star that's sitting out there 20, 50 light years away. Actually, you got two of them, okay? You got to measure the distance and you got to measure the masses. Can you do it? And you got to measure the acceleration. Let me come back to double stars, okay? We'll come back to that. Okay, and let's start with stuff that's simple. But you see there's an issue. I mean, we see double stars go around each other, but we can't, unless we can measure all of these things, we can't be sure this, we know there's some attraction between them, but we can't be sure this law is precisely the description of what's going on. So let's come back down a bit closer to what we can observe. Can anybody give me just some other experiments which test this law? Yeah? Yes, when you drop two objects, okay, they accelerate at the same acceleration. Okay. Testing the original thing, that tests that the force, let me put back the logic up here. The force, which is always the mass times the acceleration, is m1 is g, m1, m2 over r squared. So that tests that the mass is that this is proportional to mass. Because if the force is fast proportional to the mass, then that mass will cancel with this mass, and the acceleration won't depend on the mass. Okay. Do you know how accurately that's tested? Do you know how accurately? To what precision? Maybe it's true, you know, to the two decimal places and then it starts to converge. Okay. This is one of the, I actually don't know, did somebody have?
Something like 1/4 10^11.
That's what I'm getting. I haven't kept up, but this is known to something like 1/10^11. One of the most precisely measured things in the world. Okay. 1/10^11. 10^11 is roughly the size of the American economy. Is that right? Dollars? Of course, the euros are shrinking. Dollars? Okay. So you're talking about the accuracy of measuring the amount of money in the economy to $1. I could talk about that, but it's dead. Okay, but it's impressive. So yes, that's very important. That's a very important observation. Any other observations that test this?
Planets orbiting.
Planets orbiting the sun. Right. Okay. And in particular, you know the following. If I have a circular orbit, I can measure the radius of a planet, and I can measure the speed. Okay? And let's assume the orbit is a circle, although we can do it better than circles. Okay? If we measure the speed, for example, we can measure the distance, which is 2 pi times the radius. Is that right? Let's get my practice on, right? 2 pi times the radius. If we measure the amount of time it takes to go around, we can measure the speed. Okay. Now, there's a relationship between the speed, the radius, and the acceleration. Does anybody know what it is? Wow. Okay, cool. Okay. The acceleration for a circle is b squared over r. Okay. Therefore, we can measure for all the planets the distance and the b, and therefore measure the acceleration. And then we can ask, does the acceleration satisfy this formula? Okay. So it's very important, it's very important you get this clearly. You look at a planet, okay, we measure the b, we measure the r, and therefore we measure the acceleration. Okay. We also have the sun in the center. We know the r. We measure Newton's constant from somewhere. And we therefore predict the acceleration from Newton. And we ask, do they agree? Okay. And we can check it with the planets. This was Newton's big thing. Now, of course, Newton couldn't measure the mass of the sun. And Newton couldn't actually measure g very accurately, but he could deduced that this was the same G and the same M for all the planets. So if you had the R and the B for just one planet, he could deduce from this G times M for that one planet, for example, the Earth. And then he could predict what the velocities or the accelerations of the orbits were for all the other planets, as well as comets, etc. Okay. And they checked out reasonably well in this time. And they still check out pretty accurately. I don't know the accuracy. But they check out pretty accurately. Okay. Anybody have another way to check Newton's laws? Well, there are certainly lots of other instances of this. For example, the moon going around the Earth, you can check it. All the moons around all the other planets, you can check it. The comets, you can check it. And so there's a lot of checks. Okay. At the scale of the solar system. And on Earth, we can throw things, drop things. Okay. The fact that everything on Earth falls with the same acceleration, again, is a check. So this is pretty well checked out on the scale of the Earth, on the scale of the solar system. Now, suppose you really, really want to push the accuracy. Well, let's ask, what's the most precise way? Supposing we want to look at a planet moving or a satellite moving, and we want to measure its velocity, What's the most precise way to measure the velocity? Does anybody know? Actually, I don't know either. But does anybody know a very, very, some very precise way to measure velocity? We're dealing with stuff which is way out there. There's no rulers. Please? The redshift. Very good. So if I have a satellite, and we just put a little radio transmitter in the satellite, and it goes beep, 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 okay? And we hear it beep, 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 beep. So we hear the beep slower. What do we know about it? It's moving away from us. And you can very accurately measure velocity that way. So you can do the following experiment. Here's the solar system, here's the Earth. Launch a satellite. And you can receive the beeps all the way. And by receiving the beeps, you can measure its velocity. And if you know its velocity, you know how fast the distance is changing, because velocity is changed on distance, right? So you can track over time. If you track the velocity in the redshift, you can track what the distance is, starting from the Earth. And so you can send it, and then you know the distance, we know g times m, we know g, we know m for the sun, so we can predict what should the acceleration be at all times that it's feeling from the sun. And if we're sophisticated, we can track what's the acceleration also, because somebody said it was universal, it also feels acceleration from all the planets. It feels force from all the planets, and we can figure that in. Because whenever we know the distance, we know the distance from all the planets, we know where, from knowing where it is, so we can figure out all the gravitational forces on it and predict what the acceleration should be. And we can predict its motion. And we check it by measuring its velocity, by receiving the beep, 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 beep all the time. Okay? So does that sound like a good experiment to do? Awesome experiment, okay. Does anybody know about such an experiment? Okay. Well, there is an interesting thing, which is that you probably know that we have launched satellites to the outer planets, right? Does anybody know anything about those? Pioneer 10? Okay. Well, the Pioneer 10, which left the solar system, the Pioneer 11, which left the solar system, and something called Ulysses that was launched to go around the sun and then left the solar system. And do you know when these were launched? Way back in the 70s. So we're talking about 30-something years in which these things have been going beep, 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 beep. Okay. And people at Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is responsible for them, have been doing this inadvertently. They just been keeping track of where they should point the antenna to receive the beep, 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 beep. And it happens that they were well made, and they're still working. So, inadvertently, this experiment has been done 3 times. Okay? And now I can tell you what I'm worried about. This is data from Pioneer 10. Okay? And I'm not going to explain much. Well, I'll explain the following. Okay, this is the year 1986, 1988, 1990, 1994, etc. This is the signals that they received, the frequencies and megahertz of the beeping of Pioneer 10. I don't know if I, can everybody see that? Okay. And they do the following. They, from the beep, they measure it, from the beeping, and by knowing, by using this law, they predict what B should be. And they subtract the prediction. Second, therefore they get a delta B, which is error. And this is the error. It's actually with the other sign. It is actually with the minus sign. Okay. And notice that there is an error, and it's growing with time. Anybody want to comment?
Yeah. It's probably stuff after we can't see. It's actually this.
Or what? The law? What's how is that? This maybe needs correction. You're right. Okay. Yeah?
All three satellites are connected to.
Please?
All three satellites are connected to.
Yes. This is true for all three satellites. And they're going in different directions. Going from the sun. Nobody said the obvious thing about the graph, but I kind of said it's linear. What? It's linear. That looks pretty linear, right? Yeah. If it's linear, then what does it mean if there's a velocity which is increasing linearly? It means there's a constant acceleration. So it means that this seems to be off by a constant acceleration. And over here on this graph, I don't know if you can all see it, here's a measurement of that acceleration. And looking at the graph, it's around, I'll tell you what it is. I know the number, because it keeps me up at night. But is there a risk? Maybe I'll put it here. I'm not talking about the orbital space. It's about 8 times 10 to minus 8 centimeters per second squared. Is the acceleration, which is the problem. That's measured in all three satellites. It's the same number in all three satellites. Okay? That's called the Pioneer anomaly, as it says up there. Okay? This is from papers. Have you all been told about AstroPH and HEPTH, these wavelength papers? Okay. There's a way in which... if you want to look up scientific papers in physics or mathematics, you go to a website called archive.org. I think that's right. They are XIE. And there's a bunch of categories. And almost every paper written in physics or astronomy or mathematics in the last 10 years is there electronically. And you can get it. And they have numbers. There's a numbering system. And the first two digits occur in a year. So this is recent. This is 2001. I got this from a paper in 2001. And I got this from a paper in 2002. And that's a picture of the satellite before it was launched. Okay, so this is recent stuff. Okay. Now, why? Which is it? Is it that this stuff is running into stuff? Maybe. Is it that there's some gas leaking out? Maybe. Is it that they're spinning and they absorb heat even if they're very far? I think they're 40 Earth radii are 60 or 70 or something away from the Earth. And even if they're that far, they absorb some heat from the sun, and maybe that somehow gets radiated on the backside and slows them down a little bit. The acceleration is towards the sun, by the way. Or maybe, as this gentleman said, this law is not precisely right. Nobody knows, although the people responsible for the experiment believe they have taken into consideration every possible ordinary experiment, like running dust or gas or heat radiating, and it doesn't come up, it doesn't count for this, they believe. But the people running the experiment believe there's a serious issue. They believe they've measured an anomaly, which means something that doesn't agree between the laws and the experiment. But not everybody agrees. And almost everybody I know hopes that this is false, including me. Let me say something else to make it worse. We've been observing the orbits of the planets since something like, I forget the date, going back to the Babylonians and the Egyptians, we have reported measurements of the orbits of the planets back to something like 7 or 800 BC. Okay? A continuous record. The Egyptians, the Babylonians, then the Greeks, then the Arabs, etc. Okay. And the combined history of those measurements is enough to rule out this acceleration of this magnitude acting on the planets. So it's not, we know it's not just that, you know, this law has, you know, plus some constant sitting there where that happens to be that constant. Record of the orbits of the planets going back more than 2,000 years tells us that this force has not been acting on the planets, if it is a real force. Okay? But all three satellites measure the same acceleration. Okay. That's the Pioneer anomaly. Any questions about it? Okay. Everybody with me? So maybe there's something wrong at the scale when you go outside the solar system with Newton's law. And by the way, I'm not making this up. Okay. Now, how else could we check these laws? Anybody got any other ideas? Once you get worried, you gotta really check it. Is there any, so somebody mentioned double stars, and my issue with double stars is how you accurately get the mass. Okay. Now, there is a case in which you can accurately get the mass for neutron stars using Einstein's equations and some fancy stuff having to do with relativity. And that does check out very, very, very well, but I'm not gonna tell you about that. Okay, because that's not, but let me tell you, it also checks out to about 10 decimal places. So the extension of this law corrected by relativity in double neutron stars does work to 10 decimal places. The reason why it's so accurate is that neutron stars rotate very rapidly, and they give off, and they have magnetic fields, and that makes them radio antennas, and they give off pulses, which are very accurate clocks. And using those clocks at the redshift, one can reconstruct the orbits extremely accurately, and one can check this plus its corrections due to relativity, and they do check out. But just for the neutron star, they do check out. So again, on the scale of the solar system, actually even smaller, neutron stars are much closer to each other than the Earth is to the sun. It checks out very well. Suppose we want to go larger than the solar system. How would you check in this law? Galaxies, yeah. Can somebody talk me through events? I'm going to put you on hold for a moment. Can somebody tell me, how would you measure this in galaxy? You can measure one galaxy relative to another. Let me put that idea, come back to me with that, okay? I will come back to that. You can do that. Definitely come back, okay? But can we do what? Can we do it in something in an individual galaxy? Somebody tell me what is a galaxy? What? Right. A galaxy is a whole bunch of stars. And I don't have any pictures in here to show you, but you know what they look like. They have, can people see how I write here? Not well? Okay, so I'll just erase. We'll just go up. I'll just erase. Okay. So, galaxies. Now, there are different kinds of galaxies. But some galaxies, including our own, are disks, which means that they look like this from above. They've got a kind of spherical bulge in the middle. So look at edge on, it looks like it's a bulge there with a bunch of stars in the middle, and then it's a disk. It goes out. And the stars in the disk are going around in circular orbits, pretty close to circular orbits. And we can see galaxies like this, sort of looking at their top. And by the way, they often have structure. They have these arms. Some of them, not all of them, but some of them look like they have sort of arms. And then their stars are different colors and stuff. And we know that the stars are going around in a circular orbit. Some galaxies we see disk on, like this. So, could we test Newton's law in that context? Yeah, somebody tell me how you would set up the experiment. It's even simpler than that. That's for later. Save that. Somebody's saving something. You say the thing with the emission lines, and you look and save that. It's easier than that. Can somebody? The redshift. So we look at the starlight along the arm. Imagine the starlight along the arm. Okay? And in the starlight, we look for, maybe this is what you meant, sorry. We look, whoops, I don't want to erase that. 8.10 centimeters per second squared. If we measure here, the velocity, well, we look first in the center, galaxies tend to be going away from us, so there's some velocity in the center. And then what we see is that the velocity decreases to one side, which means it's moving towards us on this side, and increases on the other side. Because it's moving away from us. And by the way, we can see this not only in stars, but it turns out that in many disk galaxies, there's a disk of hydrogen gas which goes out far beyond where the stars are. And now comes the fancy stuff. We can actually measure signals from transitions in the hydrogen gas. And so we can actually get this beyond where the disk of the stars are, because it's a big disk of gas that the stars are sitting in, which is also rotating. And that gas is mostly hydrogen. Okay? So this is the way we do the experiment This is called a rotation curve. And this experiment was first done by, does anybody know? What?
I have to be doing like monitoring the satellites to test it and see if they can fish and they can do it. So we need to do like a test of whether hydrogen gas talking about will slow down the satellite like that.
Yeah, there is some hydrogen gas in the interstellar medium, and there is some around the solar system, and people have tried to figure out whether that causes a drag on the Pioneer satellites, and it's not enough. According, I haven't done this calculation myself.
Okay.
But it's not, that's a very good question. Thank you. Okay. Do anybody know who did this first?
Yes.
Vera Lubin is the person who did this first. She's a astronomer in Washington, D.C. at the Carnegie Institute. And she's about 75 years old now. Now, what would you predict? Now, by the way, that from here, okay. Now, it's a little bit complicated how we measure the distances to galaxies, and I'm going to skip that and assume that we can measure the distance. And I can come back to that if somebody wants to quiz me. Let's assume we can get a distance measurement. If we know the distance, then we know in the telescope the angle that the galaxy takes up in the telescope. And from the distance and the angle, we can get the distance r from the center to a star. Okay? So we can measure v, the velocity, and we can measure r, each star. And since you all know that the acceleration is v squared over r, you can measure the acceleration for stars in the galaxy. Okay? So we measure the acceleration. How do we check this law? Yeah, but there's, you could do that. Yeah, but there's an issue, which is that as you go out, this is not like being outside the Earth, this is like being the center of the Earth, the center of the sun. As you go out, there's more and more stuff. So it's a little bit more complicated than that. But, supposing there are a lot of stars, how do you use this law to predict the acceleration if there's not just one body or thing, but there's a lot of them? How do you do it? You add up the forces from all of them. So you look at all the stars, and you make a prediction for this. Now, so that's what you do, and now you can't actually count the individual stars in the galaxy. You can't revive a galaxy that well, except a very nearby one, and maybe very nearby Q. So you don't count the individual stars. Does anybody know how you actually do it? Again, you're great, but you're asking a more sophisticated question than I'm. You're answering more sophisticated questions than I'm asking. If you can't see individual stars, how can you estimate how many stars there are? From the brightness.
Right.
What you actually measure is the brightness, called luminosity. L, luminosity. And from a lot of experience in astrophysics and astronomy, given the amount of light in different colors, because there's a whole understanding of how different kinds of stars with different masses have spectra in different colors, from knowing the amount of light in different colors, you can make an inference about how much mass there is in stars. Okay? And this is important, what I'm telling you. So you go from the light luminosity to an estimate of mass to a prediction of the acceleration. Okay? Now, however, I'll tell you something simple. Most of the mass you see is in the center. Most of the mass is in the galactic bulge, which is this sort of spherical distribution of stars in the middle, which are old stars. It turns out, if you want later, I can tell you how we know that about old stars and young stars. Okay, but this is mostly old stars, and the disk is a mixture of old stars and young stars. By the way, the stars being born all the time in the disk. And old stars and young stars have different colors, and so there's a whole understanding of how to look at the light and figure out what kind of star is estimated the masses and so forth. Most of the mass is in the center. Therefore, if most of the mass is in the center, you would expect the acceleration when you went far enough out to be falling off like 1 over r squared. Right? And if the acceleration is falling off like 1 over r squared, and the acceleration is v squared over r, then v squared, you do this in your heads, if on this side, I'm going to just make a rough prediction. If the acceleration as a function of r is going like 1 over r squared, and that's v squared over r, then v squared is going like 1 over r. Okay? Or, as a prediction, that v is going like 1 over square root of r. So the curve I just drew, can everybody see down here? The curve, there's some acceleration here, there's some velocity here. It gets less as you go close, but it should come back. The velocity relative to the center of the galaxy should be falling off by 1 over r, 1 over square root of r. That's the prediction. Okay, from that really just has in it that most of the mass of the galaxy is in the center. So you go far enough out, you're seeing most of the mass, therefore the acceleration predicted is falling off like 1 over r squared. Just to repeat it, acceleration is v squared over r, therefore v squared has to go like 1 over r itself, so this side is going 1 over r squared like this side. Okay. Therefore, taking the square root of the velocity is going like 1 over square root of r. Which means as r is getting bigger, the velocity is going to zero. Okay, everybody got it? That's the prediction. Okay? Vera Rubin did one galaxy, the first galaxy she did. Boy, I wish I had more space. Maybe I'll just erase here. And I don't have the original data. I'm going to show you some more recent data. But now, let's just measure the velocity relative to the center. The velocity relative to the center went up on one side and down on the other side. This is zero. And flattened out. On each side. Did not go like 1 over square root of r, no matter how far out she went. She did a second galaxy. Same thing. She did 12, I think. And in all cases, the velocity flattened out to a constant. And did not, no matter how far away she looked, did not fall off like 1 over square root of r. This is called the problem of the rotation curves. Constant. She published a paper, became justly famous. We'd like to see some data. Okay, don't read the words. Here is some data. That's 1 gallon, okay? So these are data points. That's on the curve, which goes to the data. This is the distribution of stars and gas, which is deduced from the light. Okay? Doesn't fall off. Red curves are fixed to the data. Blue curves are what should be happening based on using this law from the observed gas and dust. The, all those names, NGC, etc., are the names of the galaxies. They're catalogs with, I don't know how many, huge numbers, thousands and millions, I don't know, of galaxies. Catalogs, where the star they are, what's the redshift, they each have a name of those that have been observed so far, and people look at them. Okay? This is the data of the velocity, and they don't fall off. There are a few cases to make it worse. There are a few cases where they do fall off. Mostly different kinds of galaxies. Galaxies which are elliptical, which are not disks, which are just big, round, chaotic collections of stars. I think that all the disk galaxies, they don't fall off. The rotation curves go flat. Any comment?
Yeah. When it's a disk, you found an idea, perhaps kind of simply all the knots and bump lines, you know, the X square.
Yeah, but you see the star light, and you see from various things the dust. So you can add up all the mass. You add up all the light, infer from the light the mass, and you can just go to the point. You know, there's a theorem. You can, if you have a body, you can go to outside the body, and then it acts like it's. If you outside the body, it acts like you're being attracted to the point. Or you can just add up all the forces from all the stars that you see. Okay? And eventually, you get outside where most of the stars are, and this should fall off. And it doesn't.
What's the difference between a disk and a sphere, then?
Well, actually, they don't fall off with most spheres. I'm just telling you that to make life complicated, there are a few spherical galaxies where they do seem to fall off. But most of them, they don't. Yes.
Are there any possible explanations for this catastrophe from science side?
Can you think of any possible explanations for this effect? Okay, wait, well, there must be something else creating the force. Tell me about that something else. Somebody has to stand back. I'll get to you in a second. But go ahead. Yeah, there must be something else there. That's one possible explanation. Okay. What do you know about that something else? It's not something that's conventional matter. How do you know that? We don't see it when we count up the light. Because we observe the stars and the gas and the dust because they give off light, they give off, you know, infrared radiation, if they're warm, they give off some kind of electromagnetic radiation. We see that and it produces presence. We've added up all that stuff. Okay? And that's what these blue curves are what you would predict for how the glass is falling off from all the stuff we see. And so if there's more stuff, it's being a source of gravity, but it's not giving off light. Good. So one hypothesis is hypothesis one, that there is dark matter in galaxies.
Is radiation something good for us? Does that in any way match the existence of the iron yet, I believe?
I'll come to that. Very good question, and I will come to that. Okay. Hold that question. Anybody have any other possible explanation? Yeah.
Yes, so could be worse, but maybe the gravity of the water should be a factor. It's 1 over r.
Maybe here, instead of 1 over r squared,
we're going to take the heat to 1 over r squared and add to the alpha 1 over r. That's what I'm calling for.
Okay. So, the proposal is some constant here over r. Okay. Good. Did you just invent that, or have you heard about this?
I just thought that v squared over r, like, the proportionality, right, would give you a constant velocity, you can just r, well.
Beautiful. 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 Okay. So, what you're saying, it's really fun having to work with work with. What you're saying is, so I'm going to put this number up here, okay? I'm going to raise Vera's name, although, you know, she deserves a Nobel Prize for this because she discovered this. Okay. So the acceleration by here, just because of that general question, I want to keep there, is 8 times 10 minus 8 centimeters per second squared. The second hypothesis is that the force falls off like 1 over r when you're very far away. And let me expand on that reasoning. The reasoning was, I can erase this because I've got field data there. Reasoning is that V is a constant, and V squared over R is the acceleration. Therefore, if V is a constant, when you go far away, then the acceleration had better be a constant over R. Okay? So, that's this proposal here. Okay? The force goes like 1 over r when you are far. From the center of the galaxy. Yeah. Bad data. That's an important question. Okay. Well, we have to worry about what is this constant dependent on. Okay? Now, if this is true, then let's look at many galaxies and let's see, let's measure that constant. So for each galaxy, we go far to the end, as far as we can go, and that's, we estimate where it's formed, where roughly we are, what the velocity is when it's a constant. Now let's look at many different galaxies, and ask, what is that constant? What's the relation? What determines what that external velocity is? Okay, that's an experiment we can do. What properties of the galaxy does this depend on? Okay, anybody have any guesses? What, so if I graph the velocity against some power, I want to get some nice relationship in which the, I want to know what, so in other words, I take the 1 over r out, and I get the expression that p squared is a constant for each galaxy. That's fine. It depends. What does it depend on? This is for each galaxy, but it could still change. It could depend on the mass of the galaxy, it could depend on the size of the galaxy, right? Okay? It could depend on the color of the galaxy. But the color, don't laugh, because the color of the galaxy has to do with the kind of stars. Roughly speaking, the more young stars, the bluer it is, and the more old stars, the younger it is. The density could depend on the density. Okay, so you can do, this is what we want to know. What does P depend on? Anybody know? Anybody have a guess? By the way, this is interesting, whether you believe in either one of the two hypotheses. Because on either hypothesis, if you believe there's dark matter, you want to learn something about the dark matter. How does the dark matter depend on the other properties of the galaxies? If there's a change in Newton's laws, you want to know what sits up here. And we can find out by looking at a lot of different galaxies, measuring the B, and asking what it depends on. Okay? Anybody, I've got a guess where it is here. Okay. There's some data. Can you all see it? Here's astronomers tend to plot log of stuff against log of stuff, logarithmic stuff against logarithmic stuff. Okay? That's their peculiar culture. Okay. This is the log of the velocity at the edge of the galaxy, the furthest one they can measure. Here's the data points, and this is, anybody have a guess to what it correlates with? You can see it correlates with something. This is the data, that's a line through the data, and that's a line, right?
Visible mass?
Well, actually the light. The total light. Okay. The observed relation turned out to be that B to a power, which is 4 plus or minus about a half, is proportional to the luminosity. Total luminosity. By the way, if you take the log, do you guys know enough math? You know, if you take the log of something to a power, you get that power out there. So this number up here is the slope of this curve. So you can look at it and measure the slope of that curve. With that line, and that's a straight line, Okay. And by measuring the slope of that straight line, you get 4, plus or minus an error. So as you can see, it's the distribution around it. So, here's some evidence. That's what you wanted, right? Here's some evidence. Now, physicists, so we're learning something about either hypothesis. Okay? Now, physicists operate, so actually here it is, 3.9 plus or minus 0.02 is actually the honest answer here. 3.9 plus or minus 0.02. Okay. I should look at my own data here. What?
0.02.
Plus or minus 0.2. Thank you. Okay. Now, physicists were by dimensional analysis quite a bit. So we're going to do some dimensional analysis is using what are the dimensions, have you done that here? Using what are the dimensions of things to figure out what kind of question to ask. Okay. So let me make another assumption. Okay. I told you that the luminosity is generally proportional to the amount of visible matter. Amount of ordinary matter, not dark matter, because dark matter is dark. Right? Luminosity is proportional to the amount of visible matter. So therefore, I have an equation that says b to the 3.9 plus or minus 0.2 is equal to a constant times the luminosity. If the luminosity is proportional to the amount of visible matter, this is some other constant pi times the mass, which is visible, times the dark matter. Okay? I want to know something about that constant. Okay? Now, let me make an assumption. Okay? This effect is due to gravity, right? The stronger gravity is, okay, the more energy is in the system, the stronger the forces are, the faster the stars should go around. The more the acceleration is in there, for the faster the stars should go around. Okay? Therefore, I would assume that Newton's gravitational constant is sitting there. Okay? And I'm going to assume that this is 4, because that's the simplest thing it could be. Okay, so what I have is b to the 4th is equal to Newton's gravitational constant times something times the mass, which is visible. That's what my data is telling me. Okay? Now, we could work out what kind of constant is sitting here, so let me call this thing K. Right? This is centimeter to the fourth. This is centimeter to the fourth over second to the fourth. Right? This is whatever Newton's constant is. Okay. This is a mass. Does anybody want to work it out, or do you want me to tell you what the answer is? What kind of thing this is?
I'll let it work out.
Okay. Okay. Do you know enough to know what the units of Newton's constant is? What? Somebody tell me, what are the units of Newton's constant? Please?
You know?
Meter
squared?
Newton?
Meter squared?
Meter, so this is, okay, so that's a centimeter square, which is just as good. Okay, over what? Over that ground square?
Most of the kids work in an MKS system.
Okay.
So they're probably used to it being Newton's meters squared over kilogram squared, and velocity is being in meters per second.
Is it joule again or something?
Yeah, no,
Newton
is kilogram meters per second squared.
So okay, so that's another centimeter up here.
Gram. A gram centimeters.
You get the constant from F equals G at 1 m over r squared, right?
Yeah.
So work that out. It's about 2 minutes. Work that out.
Okay, should we do it that way?
Yeah.
So everybody work it out and just come back and tell me what K is.
What do you mean for that square?
What?
Meter
times second squared? No? This is meters over second. This is meters to the fourth over second. Okay, anybody else finish? Let's give everybody else a through here, it says that B squared is square root of GMA0, which says B squared over R is square root of GMA0 over R, which means over R squared if I put it inside the square root. Okay? Which means that this term over here that somebody told me to add has the weird form of square root of GM over R squared, which is this term, times A0. Okay? Now, actually, this isn't good enough to fit the data. What fits the data turns out to be the following law. Compute. Let me call the Newtonian acceleration this original acceleration which people brought us about. Gm over r squared. Let me call that the Newtonian acceleration. Okay? I'm going to erase this. The proposed law, which fits the data, is that the actual acceleration is either the Newtonian one, if the Newtonian one is greater than A0, or the square root of the Newtonian one times A0 if the Newtonian one is less than A0. And this law is proposed by somebody called Milgram in about 1984. Now, let me tell you why I don't sleep at night. Okay? Let me go back to where we were. I have no idea when I heard about that. When I heard about that was in the course of a conversation where everybody was laughing about it. Can you believe this crazy guy? I don't even remember. Because the way I was taught, there are Rubin's observations prove that there is dark matter. By the way, the amount of dark matter you need to make the rotation curves work is about 5 to 10 times the amount of visible matter. So roughly 5 to 10, we're not talking about a small effect. There's between 5 and 10 times as much dark matter in the galaxy as visible matter. Okay, and that's what I was taught in college, in graduate school. And that there's dark matter, we don't know what it is. But that's why the rotation curves flatten out. Then I began to hear there's this nutty guy who has this nutty theory that Newton's law is wrong and that there's a different force law. Okay? And people laugh. Now, let me go back. This is a web page about the law. Let me go back to what I showed you. This is a galaxy. This is the matter seen with gas and dust. This is the measurements of the rotation curve. Look at how small the error bars are. Some error bars down here, where you're close in. Gets better out here. And why is there, does anyone know why there's error bars down here? Because this is big bulge of stars moving around randomly, and things are not so organized, so you don't get such a clean signal. Whereas out of the disk, everybody's rotating around circularly. In here, everybody's sort of moving chaotically. So you don't get a clean signal down here. There's some error bars, but you see a trend. That red curve is this law. Okay, I kind of lied to you. I implied the red curve was just a fit to the data. This red curve is this law with this A0 predicting, observing what the observed visible matter is and using this modified law to predict what the acceleration should be. Yeah?
What's happening at the peak of the curve? Is that sort of the end of the visible?
No.
There's a little cusp there.
Yeah, so there's a cusp in the visible matter.
Okay.
There's a cusp in the distribution of matter. And because the law ties the acceleration to the visible matter, there's a cusp in the predicted acceleration and the data, which agrees with the data. Now, notice, that's a very good question. This would be very hard to explain if this is due to most of the matter being dark. Because why should the cusp here, if on the theory that most of the matter is dark, is a cusp in the distribution of dark matter, just where there's a cusp in the distribution of visible matter. But why should that be? Okay. And the other bits, the other slides that I showed you, the red line, the red curve, is the theory. Yes.
What causes the cluster distribution? Where is that galaxy?
Different galaxies are different. Well, it could be there's a bulge, and there's a disk. The different constellations of stars. So I don't know the case in the galaxy, but you can see that there's a lot of structure in the distribution of visible matter, which is different for different galaxies. Okay. Now, what? Why I don't sleep. Of course, I do sleep, but for the first weeks after I saw this data, I would wake up in the middle of the night. Okay, there's lots of different galaxies. It doesn't work in all cases. Here's the list of galaxies where it works, which is 84. Here's the list of galaxies where it absolutely doesn't work. And here's the list of galaxies where it kind of works, but there's some problem. Okay. I'm not saying this theory is right. This theory doesn't make any sense, which is what I'll start to tell you now, is why it can't possibly be right. When Mr. Milgram, in I think 1984, invented this theory, all the galaxies which had been observed were bright enough and had enough matter that you had to go pretty far out on the disk to reach the point where the acceleration fell off below this A0. Okay, you pulled the A0 off that relationship with the velocity I told you about. By the way, I forgot to tell you that has a name. It's called the Tully-Fisher law. After two astronomers invented it or discovered it, this law here is called the Tully-Fisher law. It's called two astronomers. And it was just discovered by the data by those two people. Well, I have no idea who they are. So Milgram pulled that constant off the observations. And for most galaxies that we've been looking at, you have to go somewhat far out onto the disk before the A0 becomes important, as you can see. Sort of, here's the blue curve fits for a while. The blue curve is the prediction just for the extreme theory. And then the red curve gets over somewhere. Okay? But somebody, a young astronomer, whose web pages this are, and if anybody wants, you can read it off, or I can put up what the web page is. was in graduate school about 10 years ago. His name is Stacy Udall. And he knew that more recently people have observed a class of galaxies which are very dim. They're called low surface brightness galaxies because they have a lot less light, a lot less matter than most galaxies. So the class of galaxies called low surface brightness galaxies because their surfaces are not very bright. And they were not known about when this theory was invented. And he said, let me measure those galaxies and get the rotation curves for those galaxies. Those are going to be different because the acceleration is going to be small everywhere in those galaxies because they're not very bright, therefore there's not much matter, therefore there won't be much acceleration. Okay. So his PhD thesis was studying the rotation curves of low surface brightness galaxies. Okay? And that's what he found. Again, here's the distribution he saw of stars and gas. Here's the prediction for this theory. By the way, MOND is the name of this theory. It means modified Newtonian dynamics. So it works even for those galaxies, if we're not even known when the theory was invented. Okay, I'll show you one more thing, and then I'm going to tell you why this has to be wrong. So this is a paper, a recent paper. There's a particular piece of data that I'm looking for. Sorry. One more. This is, I thought you guys should see some real data. Okay, let me tell you what's going on in these charts. Okay, and then this will be the end of all I have to say about data. Okay, I told you for each point on the disk. So let me... Here's my disk. I'm observing, here's the bulb. For each point that I, when I make an observation in a telescope, I measure the R, I measure the Z, and I measure the light, the luminosity. And then I predict for each point point, I predict the A Newtonian, which is this, Gm over R squared, where M is all the matter within that radius. Okay? And then I compare it to the A observed. The A observed is B squared over R. Okay? And I call that delta A. And this axis is delta A in units of 10 to the minus 8 centimeters per second squared. And then he said, what does it correlate with? So from all the data from astronomers of good quality of this type, there is something more than 100 galaxies, 120 galaxies or something, which are close enough and bright enough that you can get many points along the arm of each galaxy, which are face on to us. I'm sorry, not, yeah, which are side, disk on to us. So you can do that. After all, if the disk is rotated, you've got a problem because the velocity is not just coming right at you. Okay? So there's just, there's 100 something galaxies which are close, bright, and they're facing us disk on, where this has been studied. And for each one, there's 10 to 20 points on each arm, which could be resolved. And this, by the way, this is hours, this is work. Yeah, one thing to emphasize about science is that it's work. This is hours and hours of people sitting at telescopes, or more recently, people programming automatic, you know, because a lot of this now is done robotically. The images are taken electronically. The telescope is programmed to look at a set of galaxies each night to do certain images. This is a lot of work. And after all this work, it's a few thousand data points, where for each data point, you know the V, the R, the mass, and the delta A. And he said, what is the delta A correlate with? Well, here's the distance from the center. No correlation. Sometimes delta A is zero, sometimes it's not zero for any distance. So it's not true that the, in other words, if you think that dark matter is relevant, it's not true that there's some distance you go far away from the galaxy, that distance, and dark matter would be relevant. Or if you think the law is different, there's not some distance, which is the threshold where the new law becomes important. It's just, you see this, there's no work for every distance. You can find a case where there's no discrepancy in Newton's law is working, and you can find lots of cases where Newton's law is not working. So it doesn't correlate with distance. This is all the data for all the galaxies which have been observed. No correlation with distance. Okay. This is rotational speed, omega. How fast the guy is rotating. Again, no correlation with rotational speed. For any rotational speed, you can find, for most rotational speeds anyway, you can find galaxies at that, stars at that rotational speed. Some galaxies we saw it working, find others where it's not working. And he's doing this twice, because over here on this side is all the data, and on this side is the best data. Trick is from the experimental scientists' work. They want to find a relationship, first look at all the data, and then look in the data of the highest quality. Because anything that's really true should sharpen the data of the highest quality. Here's the correlation with acceleration itself, with predicted acceleration. Look at that correlation. All the data points see no discrepancy. Newton's law is true. Acceleration is larger than a certain amount. And then Newton's law begins to be not true if the acceleration is smaller than a certain amount. And the relationship sharpens when the data gets better. And here's where it changes. If the acceleration is bigger than this, Newton's law is true. If the acceleration is smaller than this, there's a discrepancy in Newton's law. That's what this says. And this acceleration, read off the data, I can't do it so well by eye, but read off the data, it's close to this 1.2 tenths of minus 8 centimeters per second squared. It's actually kilometers per second squared. It's in some weird unit, it's a kilometer squared per second squared per kiloparsec. But that's what they actually can get. And if somebody wants to ask me, I can tell you why they're doing that bizarre way. Okay, so I can't read from that to kilometers per second squared. But anything, it's clear that there's a correlation with acceleration. So that this law accounts for the data in a simple way. Okay? Any questions? By the way, this is dangerous, okay? Because if you go back, to wherever you come from, or go to university and tell your teachers that Newton's law doesn't work for galaxies, you could get in trouble. This is recent data. This is stuff which is not taught because nobody knows what to do about it. And it's stuff that doesn't make any sense, as I'll tell you in a minute. Yeah?
So, is this already being zero?
It's towards the sun.
Okay.
Towards the center of the galaxy.
What if we're going to separate the building and go already past it? Yeah, according to this rule, the storage going to be net zero. But I wasn't sure.
Yeah, that's one reason it doesn't make any sense. So everyone says, they said, why don't you just have a body out here far away from any matter with no forces on? Therefore, the acceleration should be zero. Zero is less than a zero. So the law doesn't tell you what to do. That's a problem. Now, are you with me? Because if you're with me, I've told you why you should believe this. Now I'm going to tell you why you shouldn't believe it. Okay. Any other questions?
The value for A naught, is that a constant for all galaxies?
Yes. The value of A naught is the universe for all galaxies.
I'm going to probably, it is a body that you can hear it, that A is the acceleration coefficient.
Maybe. But so maybe just, if you look at this, if this is zero, then the product of this A zero is zero. So maybe that's okay. But still, what it implies is that when you go very far from anything, okay, this becomes important. Okay.
Can we take a break before we go on to the next
week? Oh, no, I'll take breaks. It's a good time to take, because then I'm just wondering why this is not
quite. Guys, there's a meeting in the seminar room. So your break is in here, you're about to be upstairs now.
Okay, how long is the break?
Whatever you want. Just 5-10 minutes.
Sure.
10 minutes. Okay, 5-10 minutes, guys.